Hi, everyone. Welcome to tonight's class. Tonight we are going to be doing the second in this four-part series of the history of Halakha, which is acting as an introduction to our year course, Halakha B'Shana. What we're attempting to do in these short weeks that we have is to review the general development of Jewish law, not so much in a in an abstract kind of way. That's a little bit more the kind of things we're going to be doing during the year. What I'd like to do in these classes is to talk about the process, the major works, why different books were written, who wrote them, when they wrote them, why they wrote them, what was each one doing differently than the other, why do some of them have lasting impact, so that when we then talk about different topics in Halakha in the year ahead, and I'll make reference to different people, different books, different places, hopefully those people, those books will resonate with you. You'll understand, oh, that's why he's quoting from the Rambam's Mishneh Torah. Oh, that's the significance of the Mishnah and so on. And it'll act as a way for you to appreciate the weight that we give to the different books, and so you'll appreciate 6:15. We just started, and so you'll appreciate. when I make reference to something, just like if I was here to say, "Oh, this is in the Bible," you'd appreciate why that is, in a sense, of greater significance than something appearing in the Talmud. But the same way that if I mentioned something in the Talmud versus something appearing in the Rambam, you'll appreciate why what it says in the Talmud is of more significance than perhaps what the Rambam may write, and so on. So being able to have that balance, that understanding of when books are written and so on, will help within this process that we're going to be going through of studying different topics in Halakha, concepts as well as topics, and I think be able to give you the most out of that class as we do it. So that's what we're doing. Okay, so last week we spoke about the original writings, obviously the Torah, but then we looked at the important first writings that we have from the sages. We looked at the Midrash, not Midrash of stories like we often refer to it as, oh, it says in the Midrash, but the early Midrash, the Midrash Halakha, the Midrash that deals with expounding, of interpreting the biblical verses to understand the laws. We looked at how those laws found expression in the Mishnah. The Mishnah organized based on subject in a very practical kind of way, not sitting there and going through the order of the Torah. Oh, it says in this pasuk this means that. Next pasuk says this, that means that, right? That's what the Midrash does. The Midrash works through pasuk by pasuk. The Mishnah is a totally different organization. It's organized based on subject. And there's less interest in necessarily the sources or the reasoning behind each of the halachot, but it's, for the most part, just stating what the halacha is in any given area of law. And it's organized based on topic, oftentimes quoting dissenting views, different opinions about a particular subject, which, as we mentioned, was something really unique in ancient times for a text, and really for any law book, even today, right? To always be sure to present the dissenting views, not just for posterity, but it also then gives an opening that if in different times the majority should see the dissenting view as being the more compelling perspective, so it's on the books. It's available to follow that position as well. And then, of course, we came to the Talmud, where the Talmud is an attempt to understand the laws of the Mishnah, to study the Mishnah, and to go, now work backwards and say, well, why does the Mishnah say the laws it says? And are there perhaps other perspectives that aren't recorded in the Mishnah? Or perhaps the Mishnah presented one opinion as the dominant and one is really just sort of the opinion that just one person holds, and the Talmud would say, well, that's actually not true. We actually think it's the flip, you know, that the other position is the dominant view. And so the Talmud acts as this incredible work of trying to really interpret, really get down to understand the principles acting behind the Mishnah. And then those principles will act as a lasting impact. somebody asked me over Shabbat about sort of the difference between the Talmud and after the Talmud, as we're going to be talking about tonight, the Talmud identifies the principles. After the Talmud, it's really going to be a question not of going back and figuring out, you know, what are the principles of Shabbat. It's really going to be a question of how do the principles, as the Talmud has elaborated, how are those applied? And so while even though normally we say, oh, majority rules, there's a certain understanding that at least this process of interpreting the Bible itself, directly interpreting the Bible, it's an art which has a little bit been lost to us. And so we're reliant on the way the Talmud interprets the Bible. Then there's going to be a whole process of figuring out, well, those principles that the Talmud identified, well, how does that apply in a scenario which the Talmud didn't discuss? Either because it just they didn't discuss that particular situation, or because maybe that scenario didn't exist yet because of, you know, developments in the way any, you know, you think about civil laws, the way companies operate now are very different than the way monetary systems worked in times of the Talmud. And so there'll be this process of trying to apply. And there'll also be this interest not only in application, but really in clarification, meaning the Talmud may say something. The question is, well, what is the principle governing this particular Talmudic, you know, position? And so in that way, we'll be identifying principles, but not figure out what are the principles of the Bible, but trying to figure out what are the principles at work within the Talmud itself. Yes?
The Talmud is closed, is that correct?
It's a work. It's a sealed work.
How was it decided, you know, that the work was sealed at a particular...
It doesn't seem like there was a specific meeting. The Talmud records that there were two rabbis, Ravina and Rav Ashi, and that they were the ones who compiled the Talmud, all the discussions and so on, that they compiled it. That happens, let's say, in the 5th century. It seems that during the 6th, 7th century, it's not completely closed, meaning the basic content has been settled upon, but there still is some tweaking. That's the period of known as the Savoraim, and this, which will be before the period we're really going to talk about tonight, which is the Gaonim. So this period of Savoraim, it seems that they continue to maybe edit. Maybe there's some additions made. And so it's not like a set time of saying, oh, this is it. Right? It's not like a work which is published by an individual, which is I published it, it's done. It seems like it was. It's a compilation in a certain sense. And that way it did. It took a period of time until it was sealed, and probably until it also then took on that status as being this, you know, sacred work which is, you know, really going to be the dominant text from that point forward. And so when we think of Jewish law, obviously it comes from the Bible. But when we think of Jewish law, we think of the Talmud, right? The Talmud is the source of Jewish law. Not the true source of Jewish law, but it is the source for Jewish law as it has been understood. And so at that point forward, it will be a question of understanding what the Talmud has to say. Not understanding what the Bible has to say. That's almost beyond us, right? It's understanding what the Talmud has to say on any given area. And so in certain ways, we're limited, right? Because we are not going back and we're not expounding on the biblical verses well. On the other hand, where our creativity, and that will be something that would perhaps be different in times where we do, where we reconstitute a Jewish government and a Sanhedrin and temple and so on, where we'll go back and perhaps begin anew that process of interpretation. But the creativity that does exist, and it's quite a lot of creativity, this room is full of mostly of books written after the close of the Talmud. So the creativity will be in trying to understand what the Talmud has to say. And not just understanding it, but also then understanding how it is to be applied. And possible contradictions between different places in the Talmud. What about when the Babylonian Talmud says one thing, the Jerusalem Talmud says something else? And there'll be different principles that govern how that process is done. Some of those principles are going to be the kinds of things we're going to talk about next week. But there's a general principle which is important, which it says, kibatrai, that we follow usually the later position. And so because of that, the Babylonian Talmud will take dominance over the Jerusalem Talmud because it comes later. And there'll be this sense that if something comes later, then, well, they were aware of what came earlier, and so they chose to go else, you know, to decide differently, then it must be that's the position, the correct position to follow. No, meaning just we're no longer adding text to the Talmud. You know, it's not going to be a debate between Rabbi Yochanan and Shalom Aris, right? That's not going to appear in there, right? Meaning the positions are set. Meaning there isn't additional. Meaning on the topics, the way they interpret the verses, there aren't going to be other interpretations that are going to be inserted into the Talmudic text. You find once in a while in the Middle Ages where you'll find in some of this types of sources we're talking about a novel biblical interpretation. But it's really you know, one in a million kind of thing.
It's like a
book. What?
It's like a book.
Right, but what we mean by sealed isn't just that the text is sealed, but it's really the what they're attempting to do is somewhat sealed. Right, the reinterpretation and so on. That's no longer something which is happening. These are the interpretations. We now take these interpretations, and the Talmud applies a lot of them, and we're going to be applied. Then the halakha will then take those interpretations and those applications, and be applying them to new situations, trying to understand them more clearly, elucidating them, trying to figure out what really is going on in this particular discussion to figure out what the law should be in practical terms. So the Talmud is full of all these discussions, and it's all over the place, and it moves from topic to topic. It's the Talmud itself is, in it broad terms, are organized based on topic because it follows the Mishnah, but within the Talmud itself, it's conversations and discussions, and the topic may be discussed in one place, but then also discussed in a different tractate. And so there's this whole sea of discussion that flows throughout the Talmud. And because of that, and it's conversations and it's debate. And so it's complicated, right? So there's a lot of complication. That's why people spend years and years and years studying it, because it's a complex text, and it's quite large as well. So there's a lot to understand there.
Excuse me.
Yes.
I see two contradictory trends. On the one hand, the rule of the majority applies. On the other hand, you might have a gadol ador, an authority figure, so great that he seems to be the one who determines the halakha, and it seems contradictory to the rule of the majority, doesn't it?
So it sort of depends what we're taught. And again, that's where we talk about sort of like different stages in the development of Jewish law, you know, about sort of like how those things are governed. Meaning in today's day and age, if there's a particular rabbi that's considered to be the greatest of the scholars, so if he, you know, understands that the law should be applied in such a way, that's a very, influential position. Because this person is recognized as a great scholar of the law. He has a great depth of understanding, and so if that's how he understands it, so that's obviously going to be quite influential. Putting that to the side, in general, if I'm studying a particular topic, and I'm looking back, and I'm looking in the Middle Ages, and, you know, of all the Rishonim, the medieval scholars, you know, 8 say one way, 2 say the other way, most likely that's going to govern what you're going to then find in the later codes of Jewish law as being the position that was followed, right? If most people think a particular way, that's usually what's going to be, that's generally the what's going to direct us on how to follow, because that's what most people think. Are there ever situations where the minority view ends up winning? Sometimes. There are times where there might be a sense of, you know what, even though most of the sages said one way, the way we understand it today, the position of those two sages really is just much more compelling to us for whatever reason. And again, each topic has to really be looked at independently to figure out what's going on, what are the issues, what are the factors, and so on. So I don't know that we'll ever be able to cover all those topics. That requires years and years and years of study and understanding the topics to the depth. But hopefully that's some of the kinds of things we'll be able to talk about during the year, is starting to understand some of those governing principles and how you evaluate and how you balance. Not really with the expected goal that we're going to be adjudicating, issues in Jewish law. That would be great if any of us got to the point that we could do that. But at least so that we can at least understand what's going on when we learn about different topics, which I think is something that would be really helpful, to everyone to understand better. Okay, so let's continue on, right? So that's sort of what we did last week. When we talk about halakhic works, works of halakha, so there's really three genres that we're talking about. There's three genres of Jewish law post-Talmud. The first genre of writing that we find is commentary. You find Karen. Who's the most famous of all the commentaries?
Rashi.
Right, Rashi is the most famous of all the commentaries. He's a Jew, he lives in France, right, an Ashkenazi Jew, and his commentary on the Talmud is considered to be the most important, right, for the ages, right? He will go ahead, it's succinct, it goes almost word by word, and as you read the Talmud, you look over and you say, oh, Rashi says these two words mean this. These three words mean sometimes actual definition, sometimes not definition, but explaining what the significance of that line is. And it's very concise, very precise kinds of commentary. Now, this becomes important, right? I'm studying the Talmud. I'm a student of the Talmud. I want to understand what the Talmud discussion is saying. But I have a challenge. I have a problem. What's going to be the most difficult thing in understanding the Talmud? For us? For you and me? What?
The language.
It's written in Aramaic. The Mishnah is written in Hebrew. It's beautiful. It's a pleasure to study Mishnah. It's actually become quite popular, I think, over the last generation or two for people to study Mishnayot, to study the Mishnah. It's written in Hebrew. And it's called Mishnaic Hebrew. It's a very beautiful Hebrew. The Talmud is written in Aramaic. It's a difficult language. If I am a student of the Talmud in the 8th century, living in the city of Baghdad, or I'm living in the town of Sura, Pumpadita, any of the important communities in those lands, and you can see on a map on page 3, I apologize, it's not so clear, the map that I have here, but if you look in the areas which is a little bit darker, those are areas of where Jews lived. So if you look, going directly above, the area where Iraq would be, between all those seas, there's towns, different important towns that exist over there. So I'm a Jew living in those places. Talmud study's not so hard. Because that's the language. That's what people speak. When it makes a reference to a particular stove, I know exactly what kind of stove it's talking about. Right, imagine, right, we're having a conversation, and we say, oh, this is a convection oven, or this is a gas stove. So we know we can picture exactly what we're talking about. But if, so imagine though someone comes in 500 years and is reading our text, and they have a completely different technology, a way of cooking, so they're going to see gas stove, electric stove. I don't know what they're talking about. I can't apply the principles that have been developed in a conversation from the year 2011, if I'm saying this is in the year 2500, if I don't understand the technology that they're referring to, because they may set a particular law only because the technology worked a certain way, and I need to understand the way that technology works if I want to understand what they're really saying when they say a particular law. So in any case, that's going to be a challenge when studying the Talmud, is that we live in a different culture, we have a different language, right? For anyone living post-Babylonia is going to have a challenge because it's talking about their world, and they're applying the law to different situations. So that becomes difficult. So Rashi follows on the heels of a couple of other commentaries that start to develop in North Africa, in Spain, and so on, that will attempt to do this, that will start trying to either give translations of words at first, and then the more you get to Rashi, which is more really explaining more closely what's really going on within the Talmud itself. And so that's a really important type of text that develops.
He writes in Hebrew.
And so that becomes a really important text because that's what's going to allow people to continue to understand what the Talmud is actually saying. And again, it's not just Rashi. There's other rabbis, Rabbi Nuchanan, and so on. If you open up a page of the Talmud, actually many of these commentaries appear on the page of the Talmud itself, right? And they're really useful tools for doing that. And this process of interpreting what the Talmud says will go on, and it will continue on. There's books probably written that were published last week that basically do this, right? This is a process that will go on throughout the millennia of people will study the Talmud, and they will try to explain what it means so that when people are studying it, they can look in their book and say, oh, that's what this debate is really all about. That's what that phrase is really saying. When there's, you know, a saying that exists. And so that's a really important kind of text. When it comes to halakha, they're not, those kinds of texts are indirectly important. They're not directly important, right? Because they're not works of law. They're books of commentary. When I'm going to be talking about legal writings, those legal writings maybe are taking into account some of those commentaries on the Talmud, but they're going to be taking into account in their presentation of law. And we talk about a legal document, those are going to be documents that have the stated goal of presenting the law, not interpreting what the Talmud had to say. Even though obviously what they're presenting will be based on their interpretation of the law. So commentary is one important kind of text. But that's not going to be the kinds of texts we're going to be focusing on quite as much when we talk about a topic. We might once in a while be like, oh, this halakha was influenced of Rashi's interpretation, or based on the Ritba'a had to say, or based on what Rabbi Chaim of Elazhin said in his, whatever the case may be. But those won't be the primary texts we're going to talk about when we talk about halakha, when we talk about law. There's going to be two other genres of legal writings that are going to be more influential. So the next one is going to be the type of writing which is known as which is going to be the response writing, the tshuvot. Tshuvot writings start to develop particularly during the period of the Geonim. The Geonim are the names of the heads of the yeshivot during the post-Talmud period in Babylonia. So during the 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th century in Babylonia, you have scholars known as Gaonim. Rav Hai Gaon, Rav Shira Gaon, Rav Achai Gaon, all these different Gaonim. And one of the things that these Gaonim produce are responsa. People write them letters. Sometimes the letters are asking for clarification of what the Talmud says. Almost like commentary, saying, oh, I'm studying this Talmudic passage, I don't really understand what this term is, could you please tell me what it means? And they'll write back and say, sure, we'll tell you what it means. We know what it means. I have one in my kitchen, right? Or kind of thing. Then you'll also have what are perhaps like, you know, the more interesting kind of things. They'll say, well, I have this situation, what is the law? And so then it'll be a treatise explaining or, you know, responding to what the law should be in that particular situation, right? Because these are the great scholars of the Talmud, and so they're going to tell the people what the law should be in a particular case. And they produce many of these tshuvot, right? It's a popular kind of writing that they have. Their primary text is the Talmud, and they are writing these tshuvot, making enactments, whatever the case may be. Now, the reason the part of this is happening is because there's a geographical shift that starts to take place during this time period, right? With the rise of Islam, Islam will spread across, right, starting in the 7th century, but into the 8th and 9th century, will spread into North Africa, will spread into Spain, and with that, the Jewish populations, which are centered primarily in Babylonia, will also go, right? Go with opportunities and so on. And so during this period of the 9th, 10th century, there'll start to be centers of Jewish life in North Africa, in Spain. There'll be centers of Torah study, yeshivot, that will open up there as well. But the Gaonim will continue to sort of be looked towards as a source of influence during at least the early point of that time period. And so they will be writing responses to these different communities and so on, elucidating, explaining what to do in different kinds of situations. Yeah, that's what there was, the Shiva Gaonim. Like, that was the name of the, I guess, institutions, or at least the name of the heads of the institutions. Okay. So that's responsa. And responsa continue to be written today, right? We have responsa. People will write a letter to a rabbi. You can buy the responsa of Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, right? They're famous. So the responsa are still written today. They're still written today. Okay. We then have another really important text. Hello. We have another really important text called, which are the codes, right? Which are works dedicated to law. An entire book, right? You have an entire code of law. We don't have it quite as much in the United States, right? But in Europe, it's a more common form of law, right? We have more common law, right? English, whatever type of approach. But the notion of creating a codex, right? An entire book of the law. You want to know what the law is? Open up this book, and the book will tell you what the law should be in a particular situation. Right? In a certain sense, what is this kind of text similar to in all the texts we've discussed till now? No, in the Jewish text we've spoken about. The Mishnah, right? That's sort of what the Mishnah is. The Mishnah is a code, right? It's organized, it's governing what to do, right? And that's going to be a feature of any code, is its organization. Now, a code can be organized in a lot of different ways, Jewish codes, and we'll look at some of those different ways, right? It could be organized based on topic. It could be organized based on the Bible. Could direct how it should be organized. It could be organized according to the Talmud. Could be the way that the code, right? It could be organized, sort of built off of a number of different approaches. And we find codes during the period of Gaonim that reflect those different approaches.
Is that considered one?
Essentially, the Aleppo Codex is actually a text of the Bible. It's one of the oldest texts of the Bible that was written very carefully. So it's an important text because it's a good reference. You want to make sure that your Torah that you've written is accurate. You're going to look in the Aleppo Codex, the Kedar Ram Tzava, but it's not a legal code. It's just a Bible, basically. Just. Okay. We start to see. Now, obviously, we'll start to have happen. Is the writing of codes that will happen slowly. There's going to be one in this century, one in the next century, that will happen in Babylonia. Starting in this, 7th, 8th century, where you have books, I don't need to go through all the names, it's not so important, the Sheol Toth and so on, different books that are written during this time period. Now there's a question exactly why they're happening. It seems like there is a challenge, meaning the Talmud is complex. The discussions happen all over. The conclusions aren't necessarily always clear. There's now lots of responsa that have been written that need to be taken into account. And so there'll be this attempt to start to organize the laws in a more clear kind of fashion that will take place. Now there's another factor which is going to perhaps, we don't know this for sure, perhaps also bring about the growth of this kind of literature, and that's going to be the Karaites. The Karaites are going to be a Jewish group that will be quite powerful for a couple hundred years during this 9th, 10th, 11th century, and they will reject the interpretations of the Talmud, of the Bible. They will take more of a literal interpretation of the Bible, and so perhaps that also prompts the need to make it clear what it is that Judaism actually believes the law should be in any given area. Because, I don't know, maybe your neighbor says, oh, this is what the law is, this is what the Bible says. And you're going to sit there and say, I don't know what it... So now you'll have a book, you can open up and you can say, no, that's not what my book says. My book says to do it differently, right? So it'll be an important text for directing the people on what to do, especially once there's now going to be a, you know, a split-off group, which is going to say the law should be, in fact, performed differently. Okay, so that'll be...
So,
9th, 10th, yeah, during this period, the 8th, starting with the 8th century, you start hearing about Karaites. So the next couple hundred years, they're going to be a group, and there's debate about how many. Some people say they're 50%, some people say they're majority of the community. It's unclear how... The Karaites are literalists. They take the Torah literally.
So it's the one that...
Probably not.
What was the name?
No, it doesn't seem to be the case. It doesn't. They don't seem to be literalists.
No?
They don't seem to be. There's a question whether there's any relationship between the groups, but at least from what we know about their practices, they seem to have also had some kind of interpretive method. As opposed to the Karaites, Karaites tended to be just more direct. You know, obviously, anytime you read a text, there's always some kind of interpretation you're using. But the point is, they generally didn't, right? They didn't.
They
didn't accept what the Talmud says as authoritative, basically, right? They went back and said, "We're going to look at the Bible ourselves, and that will, you know, direct us on what to do." Right? The rabbis have ruined the Torah, right? That was kind of their, you know, their perspective, right? They rejected this whole millennia year, you know, tradition about how the Bible is supposed to be understood, and they basically just went off on their own. And it seems like it was an influential group for quite some time. So that could be also maybe a motivating factor in the need for writing these codexes. So this is where now our class gets a little more interesting, right? To actually talk about some of the important works that were put together during that time. So I would say the most important work. There were several, but the most important of all of the codexes put together, codes written by the Gaonim, this Gaonic period, is written by a Rabbi Shimon Kayara, who wrote a book called the Halachot Gedolot, right? The Great Law. It's often referred to as Bahag, as the Baal Halachot Gedolot. That's how he's referred to. The author of the Halachot Gedolot, right? That's how he comes known. He becomes known as the author of this writing, right? A lot of times rabbis become known as the book that they write, right? That's how he's referred to. So he writes this important work, and it's significant because it incorporates all of these different kinds of texts that we've spoken about. It incorporates previous codes, what the Talmud says, different responsa literature that have been written over the time, and he compiles it all together. And he follows the order of the Talmud for the topics that he addresses. And so he'll organize Shabbat, and then he'll organize the next law, right? And in those areas, there will be an organization. The organization follows the tractates, for the most part, of the Talmud. And that's a really important work because he pulls together things from different places, but even within the Talmud itself. I mean, there may be something about Shabbat that appears in the tractate of Pesach, Pesachim, and so he'll incorporate that into this area, right? So there's an organization that takes place, a greater clarity. What he'll do is he'll quote what the Talmud says and say, oh, and this is what the law should be. This is what one of the Gaonim said. That's what the other Gaonim said. This is the assessment. You know, this is the consensus on how it should be followed. This is now going to be the law. And so there's this compilation, right? This organization that takes place in this important work of the Halachot Gedolot.
Zilaim, Moed, Nashim, and so forth. Who was the first one to set up that?
The Mishnah? The Mishnah, right? We saw in the Mishnah. We saw that last week, the breakdown. Right? That's where the six orders of the Mishnah come from that, and then the tractates are subcategories in that. Right?
No particular individual, just the Mishnah.
Maybe Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi.
Oh, okay.
I mean, he's the compiler of the Mishnah. So perhaps to credit with him, maybe, who knows, maybe Rabbi Kiva had influence. Who knows? It's hard to say for sure. Okay, so that's a very important work during the period of the Gaonim. You don't actually find it referenced so often anymore. And like in more intensive texts, you'll find reference to this work, but eventually it becomes eclipsed. It becomes eclipsed. It's an important text, but it becomes eclipsed. What will become perhaps the most important text for centuries for centuries is that of Rabbi Alfasi, Rabbi Isaac Alfasi, who will write a work that will become known. His acronym is the Rif. He writes a work which is called Sefer Halachot. It's usually referred to as the Rif. It's found in the back of every Talmudic tractate that you get, right? If the Rif wrote on that tractate, in the back of the printed Talmuds will be this Rif, will be this what's known as the Rif, the Sefer Halachot. Significant in that he lives in North Africa, right? This is not printed in Babylonia. So part of that is going to be that he's now living in a place where maybe customs have started to develop differently. Certainly, there's again been all these responsa literature, there's all these previous texts, there's lots of things going on. And the Talmud is still hard to study, right? That's just, Talmud can be difficult to do. And so he writes a work. Now his, sorry?
Where are you looking at?
North Africa. Maybe Chiron, but I forget. I'm not sure. And so he'll write this important work. And he is going to follow an interesting approach. He's going to follow the Talmud. Now, not in just categories. He actually follows the Talmudic discussion. So if you open up and read him, you almost feel like you're reading the Talmud, except he sifted out all of the elongated debates. Right, so he'll basically present, he'll say, oh, Rabbi so-and-so says this, Rabbi so-and-so said that, this is the conclusion, that's the way that the law should be. Sometimes he'll explain what's really going on in the debate and whatnot, but he basically presents it in the actual, not just in the categories of the Talmud, but the actual discussion of the Talmud, he follows it. And he picks out the pieces of the Talmud which are relevant for practical halachic, things that have practical relevance. And so, while Baal Halachot Gedolot, in his writing, he sometimes covered subjects that weren't practical anymore, maybe something to do with sacrifices or whatever the case may be. The Rif is only interested and things that have direct relevance to practical law in this day and age. And this becomes an incredibly influential and popular work. It is the main text to be studied. It is studied commentaries. There's many commentaries that are written on the Rif, sometimes people coming along to debate with a particular conclusion that the Rif had, sometimes people coming along to defend the Rif from those accusations, and sometimes texts coming along simply to elucidate, you know, what in fact the Rif had said. It's a very, very, very influential work. It becomes like a really important text that's studied in the, you know, institutions. And you can imagine, right, the Talmud is very complex, it's very confusing, and especially, right, if you're not a scholar of the Talmud, but you want to study the teachings of the Torah, so you'll sit down and you'll read through the Rif, and you'll basically get the major points that you need, the takeaway from the Talmud, and not just the takeaway from the Talmud discussion, but then the application to what then the law should actually be in practical terms. And it becomes a very, very, for even after other codes we're going to talk about are written, it still is like a very go-to kind of text. Now today, again, and once again, it's not. Meaning after so many years, it's lost a little bit of that sense of like, this is what it's going to have to be. The text that's really going to eclipse it eventually is going to be the Shulchan Aruch, which we'll talk about next week. Right? That code is going to be so overwhelmingly influential that it's going to make it that you want to study Talmud, study the Talmud. You want to study law, study the Shulchan Aruch. Why would you study a text which is about law, which isn't the Shulchan Aruch? Again, because eventually there'll be so many things written that have to be now taken into account, the Rif will just be one among many. But even as things are coming out for like 500 years, the Rif is a very important text and has a lot of influence on eventually what will appear in the Shulchan Aruch and so on. We'll talk about that We'll talk about that next week when we talk about how the Shulchan Aruch was written. Yes?
The Karaites were where?
They tend to live more in like those Babylonia, Israel areas.
And then the Bahad?
Also, in the Babylonia area.
It's a real shift away from
Yeah, this is an important time, and eventually this is going to become the major center of learning. Babylonia, right? There's going to be changes in the Islamic Empire. It's no longer will Babylonia be what it once was, right? It's really going to be right about the Golden Age of Spain. It's going to be Spain, which is going to be the major center of learning, and all then the famous rabbis that we think of in the Middle Ages, they're all associated with Spain. Also, in the Ashkenazi communities, in France and Germany, right, that's going to be where things are happening. It's not going to be back in, you know, the areas of Iraq and so on, right? Shifts to those population centers will occur later, right? There's later going to be greater shifts back to those areas. But for at least this time, during the Middle Ages, the major centers, there's still Jews living in those places, but the major centers of study and so on are going to be in, you know, Western Europe, North Africa areas. And for a time, you know, Israel also, but North Africa primarily. Okay. So that's the state of things. Someone's going to come along and is going to rock the boat, as it were, is going to produce a text whose influence is in some ways overwhelming, and in some ways, in light of how overwhelming it could be, underwhelming. And so we'll talk about exactly what we mean by that. The text I'm talking about is the text that will be written by the Rambam in the 12th century, his Mishneh Torah. His Mishneh Torah. Mishneh Torah means the repeat of the Torah, right? Let's read what he writes about what it was that he hoped to achieve with his text, and we'll look a little bit at the organization of it and understand why it's important. So if you look at page number 2, source number 2, he writes this in his introduction to his... He wrote a book where he tried to count all the 613 mitzvot. So in his introduction to that book, he writes the following... He says, I deemed it advisable to compile a compendium that will include all the laws and precepts of the Torah with nothing missing from it, so that this compilation would include all the laws of the Torah of Moses, our teacher, whether or not they have practical relevance in this time of exile. Right, so first of all, what's one thing that he's planning to do? That his text is going to be all-inclusive. It's going to cover all the laws, both things relevant and things no longer practiced are going to be included. And I will include in it everything of the Torah that has been established and recorded, omitting no relevant question that may arise, or at least I will mention the principle by means of which that question can easily be resolved without reflecting too deeply. Such is my goal in this work, to be brief yet comprehensive, so that the reader might encompass all that is found in the Mishnah, the Talmud, the Sifra, the Sifrei, right, the Midrashim we spoke about, the Tosefta, and all enactments of the Gaonim, of blessed memory who came afterwards, as well as all that they have explained and commented upon concerning what is prohibited or permissible, ritually impure or pure, and invalid or valid, and who is guilty or not guilty, liable or not liable to pay, and required or not required to take an oath. In short, there should be no need for any book written since the Torah other than this one from which to ascertain anything required anywhere in the entire Torah, including both biblical and rabbinic laws. He's telling you what he hopes to achieve. That's what he attempted to achieve. Is that I'm going to write a book which is going to be so comprehensive, so clear, and so... incorporating of all the things that have come till now, that if you want to know the law, open up my book. And this is going to be the book of all books, right? The code of all codes. This is going to be the text that will basically make obsolete, in a certain sense, all previous texts. Now, the Rambam didn't believe that we should get rid of all the other texts. And we have letters that he wrote to students and to other sages where he said, I continue to study the Rif and to teach the Rif to my students. And that these things are important, right? You need to understand where the laws come from and so on, and to see how they were developed and see the debates and so on. But in a practical sense for what the text I need to really just tell me what is the takeaway, just study my text, right? Just study my text, and that will cover all of the bases. Yes?
But wasn't so much of the Talmud that there is no takeaway because there's so many different opinions?
So what should the law be then?
I'm saying, how can he do that?
He's not the first one to write a code of Jewish law. We spoke about there were other ones. So they were doing that also, right? Sometimes the Talmud will imply which is the takeaway position. I mean, the Mishnah quotes sometimes multiple positions, but it's often clear which position they consider to be the dominant. So in the Talmud also, sometimes the Talmud will just make it clear, oh, this is the position of the rabbis, and this is the position of Rabbi Eliezer. Sometimes it'll actually conclude, halakha ki Rabbi Eliezer. The law, sometimes it'll state clearly. And so there's different, methods that were used to try to figure out what the conclusion should be. And again, when these quotes are written, it's now after a few hundred years after the Talmud, so there's been responsa, there's been commentary, there's been other codes where a lot of this stuff has started to be determined. And so the Rambam is saying, I'm now coming, the beneficiary of what everyone has done before me, and I'm now going to compile this into this incredible work. Okay? And it is an incredible work.
His book was primarily not for the scholar, but for the everyday man.
It was for everyone. This was the this was an important text, right? This is a text that would be significant for everyone. Now, it doesn't mean that there aren't any other texts of significance, but this text will be significant for everyone, right? This is an important text. Now, the Rambam does a number of interesting things with this text. Let's start by looking at the back page. The back page is a chart. It quotes the 14 volumes of the Mishneh Torah in the Hebrew and the English. 14 volumes. Within each volume, there's usually 5 different books. And within each book, it's broken down based on chapter. And within each chapter, it's broken down based on law. Okay? He referred to these as the 14 pillars. Right? His book was an organization, a reorganization. These are not the tractates of the Talmud. These are not the tractates of the Talmud. The Rambam went back. It's amazing. He went back. He went through the whole Talmud, all the literature, and he reorganized it completely. He identified, this is Shabbat, this is Pesach, this is Sukkot, right? These are oaths, these are civil laws, these are marital laws. He went through everything and broke it down and organized it. He then, within each broad category, broke it down into the specifics. Matrimonial laws? Okay, let's talk about it. We'll talk about ketuvot. We'll talk about kiddushin. We'll talk about gittin. We'll talk about divorce. Right? We'll talk about all the things. And then within each of those areas, he broke it down into chapters. And within each chapter, broke it down into law. And each section starts by saying, this area of law contains 4 mitzvot. And he would start, and he'd say, it says in the Torah the following thing, and this is what the law teaches us. These are the 3 principles that govern this law. If you're in this situation, this is what the law should be. If you're in that situation, that's the way that law should be. I mean, he doesn't just state what the law is. He states the principles at the core of the law, as he mentioned, right? And he explains how it is applied to each of the situations. It is a monumental work. The organization in of itself is spectacular. The fact that he reorganized everything. But not only did he reorganize it, he understood all of it. Right? I mean, he didn't just create categories. He then provided the content that would fill all those categories. And he clearly, from the text, had read all these texts that he referred to and understood them and synthesized them to reach what the conclusion should be, what the takeaway is about what the halakha should be in any given situation. It's an amazing, amazing text.
Did he make reference to what text he used in each area or did he put notes?
Let's read. So now we are going to get to the big point. Let's read the next source. Source number two. Rambam writes this in his introduction to the Mishneh Torah itself. He says, thus, the entire oral law, systematically arranged, will become familiar to all, without citing arguments and counterarguments. One person saying one thing and another something else. Rather, the law will be stated clearly, pointedly and accurately, in accordance with the conclusions drawn from all these compilations and commentaries that have appeared since the time of Moses to the present. So that all the laws, whether biblical precepts of enactments adopted by the sages and prophets, will be accessible to old and young alike. And so he decides, for clarity purpose, he doesn't want to say, oh, this is based on this opinion, there's another position. He said, I'm just going to state what the law is. It'll just be clear. This is the halakha, this is what you do, end of story. Right? It'll be very clear. So we'll see in a second. So let's read now the controversy. So that is what he set out to do. Okay.
It made him seem like an egotist, but actually performed a tremendous service.
Listen, he realized he was doing, I don't know if it's egotist. He knew he was creating something that was, it was a game changer. I mean, he created something which was amazing. An amazing, amazing work. So, and again, he's saying I studied the text and I can tell you what the conclusions are. Now, obviously he's a great scholar to be able to do that. You know. Yeah.
You say he was a game changer, and I would agree with that. That's commonly held. But isn't he going against the tradition of discourse?
So let's see. We're now going to see the reason. That's what I said. In some ways, it's an overwhelming. In some ways, it's an underwhelming text. Okay, it's underwhelming because it did not achieve what he set out to achieve at all, even though it continued to be a work of significance. He was the first one to do it. So that's significant. I mean, that he organized it in a way it had never been organized before, and he set out to answer all the questions. I mean, just an amazing attempt to do. Since the Shulchan... Let's put it this way. Avi. Since the Shulchan Aruch was written, no one's done it. No one's done it in 500 years. Commentary, but something that's inclusive of everything? He did everything. Taking into account any text that was written before him. Not just the Talmud. Any text, right? Responds, letter, everything. Okay. So look what it says here. This is written. We're going to study a little bit about this person next week. This is Rabbeinu Asher, known as the Rush. He lived in the end of the 13th, into the beginning of the 14th century. Originally in Ashkenaz. He had to flee France because of persecutions and ends up living in Spain. So he's been in both Ashkenazi and Sephardic communities. He writes important halakhic works that will have influence on the things we're going to talk about next week. So we'll talk about them next week. But he writes as follows. He says, anyone who decides cases on the basis of the law set forth by Maimonides of blessed memory errs if he is not sufficiently expert in Gemara to be aware of Maimonides' sources. The Rambam does not reference his work. Such a judge renders decisions permitting what is forbidden and forbidding what is permitted. For he, Maimonides, did not follow the lead of other authors who adduced proofs for the opinions and provided source references to the Gemara that enabled him, the reader, to grasp the underlying principle and arrive at the truth of the matter. Meaning he doesn't present the basis for his conclusions. And so sometimes you might not fully understand his conclusion because you don't understand what brought him to get there. So you might read it and think he means one thing, he means something else. You need to understand what's underlying to fully understand it. Instead, he, Maimonides, wrote his book like one delivering a prophetic message from the Almighty, providing neither reason nor proof. Thus, anyone reading it, the Mishneh Torah, imagines that he understands it, but he really does not. For he is not an expert in the Gemara. He cannot really and truly understand the subject, and he will err in the decisions he renders and the legal pronouncements he makes. Let no one therefore rely upon his reading of the Maimonides book to give judgment or make legal pronouncement unless he also finds support in the Gemara for the laws as stated by Maimonides. So there, in almost the same way that Maimonides hoped to achieve, was also the downfall, in a sense, of his work, because he didn't provide the reference to all the texts that he does. There are now tons and many commentaries written on the Rambam that basically set out to do just that, to present. There's a type of text called the Nosei Kelim, the arm carriers. And the arm carriers are basically commentaries that are written to support, to discuss the main text itself. Right? They're bearing the arms for the main combatant, which is the Rambam. So in these texts, they attempt to do these types of things, but there basically was a sense, and that way the Rambam was different. We spoke about those earlier commentaries. They wrote them as elucidations of the Talmudic text. They presented the argument in the Talmud and then presented what they felt the conclusions could be. So you could understand how they achieved their conclusions. The Rambam didn't do that. The Rambam just presented, this is the law in this situation, that's the law in that situation, end of story. It's an incredible work. He provides sort of the conceptual basis for his laws, but he doesn't provide the textual basis and the different debates and so on for some of his laws. And so at times there are people who disagree with some of his conclusions. But part of the problem was just the sense that this text just wasn't functional, because if you don't understand what's really underlying particular law, you can't really understand what that law is itself, right? And that's why it's always important. You overhear, you know, someone say, oh, this is the law in a situation. You don't know what's going on in that law, what's governing it. Maybe if you change one tiny factor that you don't consider to be a factor of significance, in fact, the law will be different. And that's the difference between presenting a law just as is and presenting the understanding behind the law that ultimately governs the conclusion, right? It's that understanding which is so significant, because that's what will then determine whether the law should be perhaps a little bit different in a particular, you know, in a slightly different kind of situation. So the Rambam writes this incredible work. And that way it is a game-changing kind of text, but its influence, its overwhelming influence, as the Rambam saw it to be, ultimately fell short. It becomes one text among many texts that will become part of the story that will ultimately influence, you know, how the Shulchan Aruch is written, which will become the primary text several hundred years later. And it's still a text which is studied a lot today. It's a great text to study, especially if you're studying a topic in the Talmud and you want to understand it. So it's a great text to do because he reorganizes it all. He presents it beautifully. It's a pleasure to read. It really is a wonderful, wonderful legal text. Even if it didn't achieve what the Rambam necessarily thought that it should or that it would achieve. So it happens to be a very helpful text for studying the Talmud or studying any area of Jewish law, because he just, you know, says it. However, it's not everything. You still need to go back and to understand what the Talmud says as well. And so this debate about the Rambam really was a debate about any code which was written. There was a general hesitation towards the writing of codes. Because of that problem, the people would maybe just look at the codes without fully understanding what stood behind the codes, and therefore not really understand what the code itself was really saying in a particular situation. And so throughout the period, even some of the earlier codes written by the Gaonim and so on, there always was sort of a debate. Are they good? Are they not good? Always this, at least warning, don't make the code the focus of your study. You need to make the Talmud the focus of your study if you want to fully understand the code, and sort of seeing them almost as, partners. You know, if you want to understand the conclusions of the Talmud, you know, the codes are helpful. If you want to understand the conclusions of the codes properly, you need to understand the Talmudic debate that brought them about. And so that way becomes difficult, because you have to know the Talmud, you have to know the responsa literature, you have to read the commentaries, and you have to read the codes in order to understand any of them, right? Meaning they all work together in understanding each other, right? If you want to understand the Talmud, you got to see the conclusions of the codes. If you understand the codes, you have to see all their earlier debates and how they developed and the different positions about them. And, you know, and that's why there's always more texts being written and compiled, is because it's a complex, you know, any code in that way is complex. So you look at the American legal system, so there are always right? It's based a lot on precedent, at least in certain areas of American law. And so, you know, there always has to be these new publications printing the decisions of courts in different, you know, federal courts, state court, whatever it is, basically doing it. So if I'm a judge, that I can look in these and study what previous cases have said and study those precedents. Precedents don't necessarily determine the conclusion, but they're quite influential, and there basically is this growing corpus of literature that needs to be then studied, because there isn't just like a set code. What we found, set codes don't solve the problem, because as much as the author of a code thinks their code was written in such a way that it solves all questions, invariably it doesn't, right? That's just the limitation of language. There's always going to be some nuance, some lack of clarity of when you said that, did you mean this or did you mean the other thing? And that will then spur a whole other generation of texts to understand those texts. And so that's just, you know, part of the story and, you know, the benefits, the importance of codes, but also their challenges. And so this sort of, what we did today presents sort of the development of the legal system and the important text as we're going to see. Next week we're going to look at post-Rambam texts, a lot of important works from that time, the Rush, the Tor, eventually the Shulchan Aruch, and we'll understand those texts. In the final class we're going to look at the post-Shulchan Aruch texts, known more as the Acharonim, the later ones, and to see how they function in light of everything that precedes them. And again, introduce you to some of the more important of those texts. I apologize for anyone that came late and weren't familiar with the schedule. The class is recorded and will be going up to yutorah.org. Anybody that needs this week or last week is welcome to go there, yutorah.org. And you can just search under my name and hopefully it should pop up.
They changed the format from last year.